Okay. Yeah. That's better. Okay.
Oh, incidentally, I've got to, just a minute, before you, I've got these.
Okay, that's recording just fine, so whenever you want to go ahead. this is Celia Hunter in Faces of 84. And why don't you just start at the beginning?
Start at the beginning.
I can't read so
well. I guess the beginning is somewhere during World War One. The late part of World War One, when I was conceived. I kept my father out of World War One because I was born in January of 1919.
And they kept fathers out?
Yes, fathers didn't have to go to World War One. Jimmy's father was the same way.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Even
if they wanted to go sometimes, it was pretty darn hard because they figured that fathers ought to stay home and look after their offspring and not go traipsing off to the trenches.
So that shows you an interesting change in how we think and considering it, that absolutely not considered valuable enough to have.
Mothers stayed home and fathers went off to earn their living for a family, you know. I was born into a small town, mm-hmm. and I'm a small town girl, I guess. Even today, in terms of how I look at the world, I grew up in the milieu of Western Washington, which was still very much a logging environment. And my father had worked in the woods. In fact, he continued to work in the woods off and on while I was a kid. And my dad was just a real handy man. He could do anything. He could turn his hand to practically anything physical. I mean, he was very good at mechanics and all this sort of thing. And I suppose my mother was much more intellectual than my dad. She had grown up in Michigan and had, she graduated from high school. My father never did. He was just, quit when he was 14 and went in the woods as a skid, what do you call them? I forgot. There were grease monkeys or something like this. Anyway, they greased the skids for the sleds that hauled the logs out of the woods. Learned to chew snooze and, you know, do all the masculine things. And he was very handsome and black Irishman with very dark hair and very blue eyes. And I could see why my mother fell for him. Anyway, they got married in 1916, I guess. And I was their first offspring. And much doted upon, as I can see from my baby book and all the pictures and everything. And I think my mother was very happy during that period of time. I think she became increasingly unhappy later on, partly because she was a good Victorian woman. And I think good Victorian women carried within themselves the seeds of much unhappiness because they had very high ideals of what a woman ought to do and be, and a good wife and mother and all this kind of thing, and was often at odds with their real desires. And I think in her case it was. She'd start teaching school in 1906 and in a mining town in Montana, coming out of high school. She was 17 and came all the way to Montana on the railroad. Her father worked on the railroad, and he found out they had jobs in Montana, and so he talked her into coming out and having a try at it. And she taught school in Montana for a couple of years, and then eventually the family hopped right over Montana and came out to Western Washington. And so she came out to Western Washington and then got jobs in logging camps in the Snohomish County area, up at Oso and Jordan and a lot of places that are nothing but a wide spot in the road these days, but they were very busy communities at that time. And so she had a fair sense of adventure she had to have a strong personality in order to get along in those rough schools, because many of the boys were almost as old as she was and bigger. Mm-hmm. And she had to, by God, make them toe the line. Mm-hmm. And I think that she had a very healthy ego at that point, and she was very competent, and she was a very good administrator. And she was considered the head of the Snohomish County Schools, but of course a woman. And she was encouraging my mother to go on into administration. And she probably could have risen to the top, because it was during that era, mm-hmm. if you had ability, you could easily get ahead.
What a terrible conflict for her.
Oh, well, I think she made it a conflict. I think, as I say, mm-hmm. it's just this ironclad conscience, you know, mm-hmm. that so many women of her generation were afflicted with, that they couldn't neglect their families. And yet, by being less than they could be, they were neglecting their families. And, of course, they didn't see that.
Mm-hmm.
And by being unhappy, and, of course, my father started drinking, and I can see why. I think it was his natural reaction to
mm-hmm.
being
mm-hmm.
unhappy and her unhappiness. And I grew up with taking my mother's side against my father.
Oh,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that it was only in later years that I began to have a healthy sympathy for my father and understand
mm-hmm.
exactly what he'd gone through. And he was a very fine guy. He was
mm-hmm.
a man who never shirked his responsibilities, and he cared for my mother clear up until it got to the point where he couldn't take care of her anymore, because she was fairly senile and
mm-hmm.
Very incompetent, and so we finally had to put her in a nursing home. But up to that time, and I don't know, there's so much of that. I think I was very much dominated by my mother during the time I was little and growing up. And in some ways it was very good, because when I knew her, when I was young, her English was excellent. She was very literate, very
mm-hmm.
articulate. And I think that if I have any flair with words, that I got it at that time, and that my ability to use English and correctly and to express myself was very much part of that upbringing. I think that she gradually gave up over time, and her language became rather slovenly and became typically colloquial
mm-hmm.
in the sense
mm-hmm.
of Western Washington. So that later on she was not nearly as much of a model as she was when I was growing up, when she was much closer to being a teacher and had much more pride and independence than she did later on. But
were you ever conscious of maybe thinking that this would not happen to me?
Oh, I don't think so. I never did it that
mm-hmm.
consciously. But I think my mother gave me a very healthy sense of my own worth.
Mm-hmm.
She was, that was one of the heritages that she did bequeath,
mm-hmm.
and I think that was I never had terrible self-doubt. I just kind of floated along as I look back on my growing up. I felt restricted because the family didn't have all that much money, but it never occurred to me that that I couldn't do anything I wanted to do. And I think that I couldn't go to college because the folks didn't have any money, so I went on to business college. My dad worked hard to put me through business college for a year, after which I was launched into the business world of Everett, Washington, which is a regular mill town. And I worked in lumber mills in Walton Lumber and warehouses. But at the same time, I had one of the real influences on my life was a man named Harris Erickson, who was actually a Baptist minister, but he was very close to being a Quaker also in a lot of his views of life. And during my later high school years, he was the pastor of the Baptist church in Marysville, and because my cousin Joyce, who's now down in Kodiak Island, was a Baptist, why I kind of went to the Baptist church. I'd grown up in the Congregational church. Marysville didn't have any Congregational church, so I went to the Baptist church. And outside of being almost saved one time, I managed to avoid most of the Baptist frame of mind. And Harris Erickson did open up many vistas to me of possibilities in terms of thought. You know, we're all like a garden plot. There are certain seeds that can be planted and will grow as far as we're concerned. And there are other seeds that we just kind of reject. And I think that I was very fertile ground for being a good liberal individual, and he furthered those tendencies. So that I had this view of life. My worldview was very much shaped by the ideas that he implanted and nurtured, which is I very much appreciate, because in a small town like Marysville, that's hard to find that kind of a worldview, and that really tailored the way that I felt about war and the way I felt about racism, and all these things have been very much an outgrowth of that.
How old were you then?
Oh, 16, 17.
Mm-hmm. Really good planting time.
Oh, it is. Mm-hmm. It was very fine. Mm-hmm. And I went on, and I just kind of never got into the usual routine of small towns where most of the girls, all they did was look around to see whom they could get married to as soon as possible and start a family. And I just didn't fall into that trap at that time. And then I learned to fly, and it was about when I was 21. And I was working for Weyerhaeuser Timber Company then, and I think everybody blossoms when they have some skill or some ability which sets them apart from other people, which makes them unique. I think that this is an awfully important thing to remember with kids, is that whatever you can give them that makes them, that gives them something in which to excel, where they are, or where they have something that's different than others of their age and strata, that is very important in creating a self-image which they carry then all the rest of their lives. And I think flying just triggered a lot of things as far as I was concerned. And in the small world of Milby at Weyerhaeuser, it really set me apart, because eventually I went on and earned a flight scholarship in the Civil Pilot Training Program, and everybody in the mill took a personal interest in my progress. It makes you feel special,
that's
you know,
right.
And it's really
so
it's really wonderful. Another influence which was really important in that formative period, and this was from 21 on, was the friendship of Doris Bigelow, who was the director of the women's program at the YMCA. And as soon as I got a job and started earning money, I went to the Y and joined, because I liked to swim and I liked athletics. I'd been good in athletics when I was in high school. And so we had we'd have exercises, and then we'd have a swim, and eventually it turned into an eating club also. So it wasn't very conducive to losing weight. But Doris was just a person who was enormously competent. She had been married and had a couple of kids, and her husband, who was a YMCA secretary, had died tragically as a result of an explosion, a Coleman stove explosion, when he had the Jerry, the younger boy, had been with him up at Lake Stevens, and this Coleman stove exploded, and he died as a result of the burns that were in question. And she never remarried. She decided to I don't know if she had men who wanted to marry her, but thank goodness she never never got trapped by any of them, because they were not really the kind of people that she could appreciate. And she had very good colleagues there at the Y who fulfilled her need for companionship and working together and that sort of thing. But she and I had a friendship which lasted until her death in 1970. And she really took the place of my mother at a time when my mother was sort of turned into herself and feeling very persecuted and was losing, was not able to maintain her real equilibrium. And I think that Doris gave me a lot to strive for and encouraged me and supported me and was just a really good friend and influence on my life. When I learned to fly and got my private ticket, I took my mother up as my first passenger and Doris was my second. So and she just was always there and interested and never judgmental. My mother was horribly judgmental about a lot of things, but Doris just never was judgmental about things. She was very accepting and very she was not wishy-washy, but she was somebody who had a most positive outlook on life and really influenced me very much. And
she was there at any time all through your life to make contact with
them. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I kept in touch with her continuously. Mm-hmm. I wrote letters and we were all, and always when I got home, I'd look her up, and eventually Ginny met her and Robbie met her, and she knew all the people in my life and was, just somebody who was very important. And her daughter has now become a very dear friend. Her daughter, of course, was a little snotty-nosed kid when I first knew Doris. I didn't pay any attention to her. but she's an amazing person, too. And so those are some of the major elements, I think, in my what went into beginning to function as an individual. And I suppose that helping to found the first flying club in Everett, Washington, and with the eight fellows. Early 20s. Put our money together, and everybody put in $100. We were nine of us, and we paid $900 for an Aronca Champion airplane, which was our flying club plane, and we flew it all over the country.
As a woman, you were probably treated as an equal at that time because you were.
There was no. It was just real camaraderie. Put down because I was a darn good pilot. I could fly just as well as they, and we were all learning together, and so it was not you didn't have any sense of these guys never figured that little girls ought to stay home and play with dolls or anything of the sort. They just were all so interested in flying that we could hardly stay out of the sky or just stay away from the airport. So that was very, very important. And, of course, that ultimately led to my getting in the WASP. However, after getting my flying ticket and during the first year that the United States was in the war, and I finally quit one job at Weyerhaeuser, was hired back to do another. And I quit the one job because invoicing was just a bore. It was just, you just sat and typed all day, and I just got fed up. So then they hired me back to be an inventory clerk, which I got to ride my bicycle from home to work and wear slacks and go out and inventory all the piles of lumber out in the yard, which was great. Lovely smelling pine and spruce and cedar and everything, So that was kind of fun. But then I decided that Weyerhaeuser didn't have any future for women. I looked around and there was not one woman in management in Weyerhaeuser. Everybody had a...
What year approximately was that when it was?
Well, for 1942.
Okay, yeah.
And I would have been about 23 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I decided Harris Erickson was still about, and he suggested that I go to Linfield College down in McMinnville, Oregon, which was a Baptist
mm-hmm.
college. So I did. I went down, and but I just got in one semester before I joined the WASP.
Mm-hmm.
And, I never went back to Linfield.
What?
An Air Force service pilot.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that was started in the fall of 42 as the Women Air Ferry Service or something like this by Nancy Love, who gathered together a bunch of women who had really a lot of experience, each one of them, and they began ferrying airplanes for the military and did such a good job at it that they then decided to go ahead and train mm-hmm. other women to mm-hmm. to assist in the work. And so I was in the class called 43W5. Jenny was in 43W4.
Mm-hmm.
She went. She reported in February of 43, and I reported in March of 43. So we were one class apart all the way through our training. And then she went to Long Beach Air Force Base, and I went over to. I wanted to go to the East Coast, and I'd never been to the East Coast. I've always. It probably was not a good choice. I probably should have gone to the West Coast because they had more interesting airplanes to fly. I didn't realize that. But I went to the East Coast because I'd never been to the East Coast. I wanted to know what the East Coast was like. So I went to the East Coast and flew P-47s and all sorts of airplanes and manufactured back there, and then picked up airplanes in Long Beach from time to time to ferry them back. But that was an interesting, very interesting experience. And being associated with this bunch of women was really something because they came from every walk of life. Mm-hmm. Some of them were married. Some of them were mothers. Some of them... there were lesbians, there were all types, there were just every kind of woman involved mm-hmm. in this. And so you had a real cross-section of people, and you learned to get along with a lot of different types of people,
mm-hmm.
and you were all involved in one effort, though, and there was a camaraderie again.
Mm-hmm.
I think that more than most women, probably, that Jenny and I have felt this sense of camaraderie, which so often is exclusively male.
That's right.
Men are involved in endeavors like this, in team
mm-hmm.
sports and in all that
mm-hmm.
kind of thing, and they have the sense of camaraderie always. But
it's never been thought of as a feminine thing.
No, I think that's mm-hmm. one of the real
mm-hmm.
pluses of much that I have done
mm-hmm.
in life is that I have shared this feeling of camaraderie with other women. And with other, and with a lot, with men too. With
mm-hmm.
You know, it's not been an exclusive thing, but it's,
mm-hmm.
but sharing it with other women has been different, because
mm-hmm.
I think that's something that is so rare. I think you find it much more nowadays because
sooner,
of the movement.
Yes, that's right. But if it happened sooner, the movement would have progressed much faster. I think
so too.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
I think that women have always been. Kept apart from each other.
That's right.
They've been separated by superficial differences.
Mm-hmm. And I think that probably that has been fed a great deal. Probably hasn't escaped anybody that's about a powerful group that would become if they ever got together.
Well, it's hard to say whether it's as deliberate as that. I have thought a lot about the Middle Ages and the women who went into the convents, and the one woman who was so outstanding in the 11th and 12th century.
She was the one that wrote music?
Yes.
Yeah.
What was her name? It popped down. It's not Hepzibah. Anyway, she. I suddenly got the impression, you know, that for women, the convent was a marvelous institution.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the sense of because they were repressed in it, which they were,
mm-hmm.
and because they were quite dominated by the males who were above the people in the convent, but the women really ran that institution.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an environment in which they were free, in which they could write music,
mm-hmm.
in which they could manage, in which
mm-hmm.
they could organize, in which they could develop all of these skills which were totally useless to women outside of the convent, because
mm-hmm.
there they were completely second-class citizens and just dominated by males and lived a life of drudgery and childbearing and this kind of thing.
And
the women in the, and the women in the convent never had to bear children. And consequently, they had a great deal of freedom to develop in many other ways. And granted, a lot of times it could have been a very repressive situation, but at other times it wasn't.
It was one of the few, if probably I can think, probably the only method of escape if you did not want to go marry and have children and see what happened to other people.
So it's, you know, because I think that that just suddenly made me realize that, life was not unadulterated drudgery and that sort of thing for some women clear back in those eras. But, I think the freedom to be independent, the freedom to be yourself, and the freedom to be independent that arose during the war, because women were put into many, many situations they hadn't been in before. And because of the sense of camaraderie, because of this being together and being supportive, having support and your support group was not anything formal at all. It was just the group of women that you could always rap with because you all had, you were sharing similar experiences, and you were other people, the people you were associated with knew your weaknesses as well as your strong points. You couldn't kid anybody. If you couldn't handle something, they knew about it. But there was a great deal of charity. There was a great deal of compassion and caring, so that people made up for other people's lack. Like, I remember when we were in the WASP, and there were some members of our flight groups who couldn't navigate, and we'd all shepherd them around the course. Everybody was looking out for them and trying to keep them from going off in the wrong directions. So you had that, really good sense of being accepted. That acceptance was tremendously important. I think that that really paved the way for a lot of us to do different things when we get home after the war. And
this is probably a good stopping point. Yeah. And I'll flip it over.
All right.
We don't have to stop.
Don't
have to do anything.
No, but I have. Well, let me see. Where were we?
Well, you were in all helping each other in the Second World War.
Well, and I was going to say that another of the people, of course, who really picked me up and moved me into a new dimension was Jenny, because of the way that she had grown up. Quite different than I grew up in a workaday world in which you got a job and you held that job and you made your living and on this sort of thing, and you were a productive member of society. Jenny's background was quite different in that she had been a product of, well, she had a vivid imagination all of her life, I imagine, and she had been a graduate of one summer camp experience after another. I'd never gone to summer camps in my youth, because they just weren't part of my existence. They were probably available, because after all, she's only a year or so older than I am, but I just never been part of what I thought about. And she had gone to summer camp. She had started doing it when she was young enough to be a campfire girl and go to campfire girls' camps in the Cascades in central Washington, and then had branched out and gone clear down to California and worked on dude ranches and camp situations, and then finally got on a dude ranch. And during the early part of World War II, that was what she was doing, was working as a horse wrangler on the Kleeberger's Dude Ranch down at Echo Lake and Lost Lake down in the Sierra. So she had this, the world was more her
realm than mine. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd grown up in Western Washington, and I was fairly well constrained to that area. And even though in 1940 I had traveled on a bus all the way to San Francisco to see my brother, who was in the military down mm-hmm. there, and so on. But I didn't take the world and make it do what I wanted it to do, or I didn't find the things that,
or didn't
you know,
occur to you that you could.
No, never mm-hmm. did, yeah. particularly. Mm-hmm. And so during that same time, then she had also learned to ski and had been part of a gang up at Mount Baker who had done a lot of outdoor, ski mountaineering and all this kind of thing. She was a very good skier for that era, and had a lot of camaraderie with a lot of the guys that went up skiing, you know, in that period before the war. And then she had learned to fly in the college civil pilot training program at the University of Washington. Again, it was one mm-hmm. woman and mm-hmm. nine fellows, but it was mm-hmm. Based on mostly you just had to sign up for it. You didn't have to go through any exams or anything like we did. I won mine over a lot of women. Incidentally, a lot of these gals that I see down in the Seattle area, several of them were in the civil pilot training program in which I won my flight scholarship back in 1940.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I still see them, but still enjoy them.
Yeah.
So it's, but anyway, during that time, of course, so Jenny was combining her love of the outdoors and skiing and camping and all this sort of thing, along with flying. Mm-hmm. And then she got into the WASP. She went, when she was through with her civil pilot training program, she went on and became a flight instructor course in Lynn, Washington, which she actually wrote to me and asked me about joining, but I didn't take her up on it because at that time, that was when I was sort of disillusioned with flying and flyers, and that was when I went to college. Mm-hmm. So I didn't.
That was when approximately?
It'd be the summer of 1942.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that was the very first contact I can ever remember having with Jenny. And we didn't really become good friends until we were disbanded. The WASP were disbanded in December of 1944, and in March of 1945, we started carrying surplus airplanes together mm-hmm. for an outfit in Portland. And she had been asked to get in touch with me by B.J. Erickson, who was trying to find WASP who wanted to do this
mm-hmm.
for the outfit in Portland. And she just happened to finally discover that my phone number was Marysville, not Everett, although my address was Everett. And so she got in touch with me, and we took off together on a bus headed for Portland on March 19th of 1945, and ferried surplus airplanes together during that summer. And we became good friends because we both liked to fly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And we liked mountains and weren't afraid of them. This was not because I'd ever spent much time in the mountains, but it just appealed to me. And so I didn't mind flying low in the mountains or mm-hmm. any of this sort of thing. It was great. We had some other gals in our outfit who were flatlanders from Kansas, and they would go 10,000 feet high and stay there because they just were scared to death of mountains. So we would go buzzing all the sheep herders and everything. And when that job concluded, her uncle had an apple orchard near Hood River, Oregon. And so he needed some help because the migrant workers weren't coming north, you know. It was the end of the war, and everything had been disrupted. So we went and picked apples together and saved up enough money to rent a ski cabin up at Mount Baker. And she told me all these tales. She's very good at painting pictures of all these adventures that she had all her life. I was fascinated.
Mm-hmm.
And so she talked me into sharing the cabin at Mount Baker with her. And that fall also, she went and bought a sailboat, because she'd saved her money during the war. And so she needed somebody to help her fix the sailboat up to sail the next summer. And so I was a natural. Anyway, hey, I was game for anything. I didn't, you know, I had no set idea of where I wanted to go or what I wanted to be. And I certainly didn't want to go back and work for Weyerhaeuser. So we went up in the mountains, and I learned to ski with a pack.
because mm-hmm. she was a good skier, and she could carry a pack, and she could go everywhere. So I just learned to ski and carry a pack and go everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we went camping together, and it was really my introduction to the outer doors and this whole world. And I thought, gee, that's really neat. And then the next summer we came down out of the mountains and spent about a month getting the sailboat ready to sail. And then another WASP came out from Missouri and joined us, and the three of us spent the whole summer cruising up the Inside Passage.
Oh, wow.
And just had a wonderful time. Mm-hmm. Just an incredible experience, you know. But of course I had all kinds of hang-ups when I was worried because I wasn't amounting to something new. I really ought to settle down. I kept thinking I ought to settle down. I've always thought I should settle down. I never quite made it.
The thing I admire about you is that you never settled down. You've managed to do all these things instead of settling down.
Well, but I didn't do it without qualms of conscience, mm-hmm. let me tell you. Thinking that I really ought to be I ought to go back and get a job. But every time I would just settle down and get into a job or something like that, didn't come along with another idea about where we ought to go, what we ought to do. And I never could resist. But anyway, we spent the whole summer sailing, and theoretically we were sailing to Alaska, but of course we found out that it took a lot longer to go from one place to another than we'd anticipated, and we didn't like to sail at night because you missed a lot of scenery, and besides, the insurance on the boat wasn't any good if we went up into the open mm-hmm. ocean, so we turned back when we got to Stewart Island and came back down to Victoria, at which point we all got mail. And Pete found out that her boyfriend had married somebody else. And Jenny found out that the guy that she was supposed to fly for that fall had killed himself in an airplane accident.
Oh, dear.
And I got an offer from John Titcomb, who had been one of the bosses at Weyerhaeuser Timber Company, who had noticed that I was different than the rest of the mm-hmm. women there and much more independent. He wanted me to come and be his executive secretary when he started a whole new pulp mill in Springfield, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And I think each of the three of us thought, oh, God, what is this? We'll go to Alaska. Well, he never did. Pete went back to Missouri and went back to flight instructing. But Jenny and I, I wouldn't have probably built any, made moves toward Alaska, but Jenny was very determined. And the first thing I knew, here she came driving up to Whiskey Ridge in an old Army travelall that she'd bought, mm-hmm. secondhand, surplus, and proposed that we drive it to Alaska. And my mother, who was quite accustomed to my flying everywhere in the world, but not driving, she thought that was a very dangerous trip. Mm-hmm. It wasn't easy. Mm-hmm. So it was as a result of her trepidation that I got in touch with George Wolf, who's the husband of one of the gals that I learned to fly with in 1940, who was selling surplus airplanes, and said, hey, do you have any airplanes that need to be flown to Alaska? Mm-hmm. He did. Mm-hmm. And that's how we got started. went off to Alaska. And the subsequent history of that, of course, is that we spent about 8 months in Alaska instead of just going up and turning around and going back. We both mm-hmm. had jobs in Seattle, mm-hmm. but we didn't get back to them. Mm-hmm. And we came up to Alaska to look around, and we got, that was when we started working for Chuck West and started flight instructing for on the side, and mm-hmm. Taking trips out to Nome and Kotzebue, and Alaska was just so exciting, and many possibilities.
About what years were these approximately?
That was 1946. Well, we landed January 1st, 1947 in Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And then we stayed until August, late August. And at that point, everybody that Jenny had met Woody, we'd met Gordon, Herod, mm-hmm. and Woody, at Birch Hill skiing. Mm-hmm. They were students at the university. They were both leaving to go back to California to go to school. And a lot of the other fellows that we had run into, there's a lot of XGIs at the University mm-hmm. of Alaska then, and they were doing them damnedest things. Some of them were getting a Jeep, and they were going to drive all the way to Tierra del Fuego. Mm-hmm. They were just
great.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Somebody else was going to float down the Mackenzie River from mm-hmm. Canada, Southern Canada into the Arctic Ocean. And somebody else, I think they just had all these ideas. Well, we came across it and noticed that we could go to Europe as students at the University of Stockholm, and that was how we went abroad.
Oh,
and so we went over as students with a whole bunch of GIs, ex-GIs,
mm-hmm.
both men and women, at the University of Stockholm. Spent about 5 months living and going to school there, and got bored with Sweden. And that was when we started off, went down to the Austria and skied in a couple of different places, and then picked up bicycles in Lake Como and bicycled all the way up to Finnish Lapland.
Oh,
and then hitchhiked our way from there across the northern Lapland to Tromsø, and then hitchhiked our way on boats down to Antwerp and London.
How old were you at this time? In your middle 20s?
Oh, and we were in our middle to late 20s.
Oh, okay. Wow. You've done more by that time than most people have done their whole life, so keep going.
Well, you know what, and this, of course, is the thing that strikes me when Romani's worrying about the fact that she doesn't know what she wants to do with her life
mm-hmm.
and so on.
You don't have to worry about it either.
No.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
You have such a good memory. You always remember it. So you were up here, and you...
Yes, we came up, and then of course, went to Europe for a year and 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And coming back into the United States, both of us were struck by the affluence first of all, a sense of sameness in every community. We hitchhiked our way across the Atlantic
mm-hmm.
to begin with.
Across the Atlantic?
Across the Atlantic from Oslo to Aruba in the Netherlands West Indies.
Uh-huh.
And then from there we picked up a contract tanker for Standard Oil and hitchhiked a ride to New York City.
Uh-huh.
And then Jenny bought a little two-wheel drive Jeep station wagon, and we drove that all the way across the United States. My back was shot by that time. I hadn't had a spinal disc operation when I was... I hadn't had a spinal disc operation yet. I wrecked my back when I was about 18 by diving and popping a disc. And then it had gone back in. But then so much sitting and everything would bring it out. And then, of course, I was on a Norwegian tanker with a hammock. And I should have been sleeping on the floor. I would have been fine had I slept on the floor. We'd slept on floors and
mm-hmm.
decks and everything all over Europe. But when I got back to the United States, my back was out. And... it stayed out all the way across the country. The interesting thing was that when we had met Woody in Switzerland, we met him in Paris, and then we had gone hitchhiked through Switzerland with him. And he at that time had just had a spinal disc operation.
Mm-hmm.
And he described his symptoms, and they corresponded with what I was being afflicted with. So I realized that I had a popped disc. And of course, this was not very usual. Nobody knew about popped discs late 40s,
mm-hmm.
but when I got back to Everett and talked to my doctor and told him about Woody's symptoms and so on, he said, well, that's what it sounds like. So I wound up in a hospital and had a spinal disc operation in March of 1949, and
mm-hmm.
Ginny came back up to Alaska driving a car, and I flew up later.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't able to, I couldn't have driven because I was just out of it. And so we went to work for Chuck West, and
who's Chuck West?
Chuck West is the guy who started West Tours,
the
big tour
okay.
operator.
Uh-huh.
It was he started out with Arctic Alaska Travel Service,
uh-huh.
and we worked for him then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was later, after we had left his employ, that he started the West Tours,
mm-hmm.
the big tour wholesaler.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we were running Camp Denali, Chuck was wholesaling tours then, and he put Camp Denali in his brochure, and that was how we got part of our start in Camp Denali.
Why did they give you the idea for Camp Denali?
Mm. Oh, because we'd seen these places in Europe that were
mm-hmm.
like this. We'd seen the Swiss lodges where people went and stayed and then hiked and did
mm-hmm.
all kinds of outdoor things. And then we'd gone...
But you started it from scratch. There was nothing
Yeah,
there,
there was nothing at all there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we'd been in Scandinavia. And
mm-hmm.
Scandinavia had ski lodges and places that people went in the mountains to hike. And then they'd hike from
mm-hmm.
hut to hut, you know, as they went across. So we sort of began to get the idea of a resort that was geared to very active people,
mm-hmm.
which Alaska did not have. It had hunting camps and it had fishing camps. It didn't have anything
mm-hmm.
like that. And so we were starting it from scratch. We thought, first of all, we wanted to have a place where people could really sit and look at Mount McKinley whenever it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to find a place out around Wonder Lake to do that. And we found this site, and it was in public domain, so we claimed it as a trade manufacturing site
mm-hmm.
and built the camps.
And mm-hmm. we just did it as our fancy dictated. And what, you know, we really trained people to want what we were offering, not the other way around, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. people didn't even know such a thing was available.
Mm-hmm.
And we created a whole market. And mm-hmm. eventually, you know, it became the popular thing to do, but we were out there a long time before we had any company, you know. Before we had any, oh yeah, well, Alaska Magazine didn't even have a category for mm-hmm. wilderness lodges or mm-hmm. for wilderness trips or for wilderness guide outfitters before we started. And we sort of got them going on all that. So we really did a lot of pioneering. And I think that's one of the things I feel good about is that we did that with Camp Denali. And again, it was one of those cases where we certainly didn't have money and we didn't know where the money was coming from, but we started and we had a good idea and we got a lot of support. Mm-hmm. We got, you know, and we had people working for us for nothing and, you know, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. We created that camp on a shoestring, just mm-hmm. totally, and built it up for 25 years before we decided to sell it. And we even persevered after Woody and Ginny split up, which was pretty traumatic because mm-hmm. that left us having to do all of the...
Oh, Woody was with you at first.
Yeah. Woody quit the Park Service in 1952, and we all started building camp together.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very much part of camp through 1960, and then at that mm-hmm. point when he decided to go, he decided he needed to amount to something, so he went mm-hmm. back to school
mm-hmm.
and went down to Seattle, and eventually they split. And so we had then to decide whether we were going to continue camp or drop it, and we said, well, we'll continue. And of course, people like Bruce Foote came along and
mm-hmm.
gave us a hand
mm-hmm.
when we badly needed it and
mm-hmm.
furnished
mm-hmm.
mechanical ability and mm-hmm. That sort of thing, because it did take a lot. It took more than we had
to
make the camp go,
mm-hmm.
and but we found it when we needed
mm-hmm.
it. And I think that's the other thing that I feel good about in the things that we've done, is that we've never let money or lack of it stand in our way in doing something that we thought needed to be done. It's like starting the Alaska Conservation Society, which
mm-hmm.
we did with great hopes and no money. You know, that became a real influence in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we got into conservation very early because up until 1960, there really, conservation was a very peripheral issue in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
It was people in the outside of Alaska were worrying about situations up here and wanting to preserve areas and that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. But people in Alaska, they couldn't imagine that it would ever be different. And it's...
We're also short-sighted.
Oh, yeah. Well... And of course, we were in the forefront of all
mm-hmm.
the major issues that came up during the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And then by 1970, I'd gotten pretty well fed up with it. I you know, you can only do something so much and be as engrossed in it as
mm-hmm.
we were.
Mm-hmm.
The little cabin was the headquarters for the Alaska Conservation Society.
Oh, my God.
And we had our mimeograph machine there. We had our subversive press. And we really did just a lot with what we had available, and but we had very good. That was another thing in which camaraderie existed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the environmental movement. We were very much embattled, and we all knew each other, and we were shoulder to shoulder. It would have been impossible for anybody to infiltrate because they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
We were too small. We were everybody knew everybody else that was involved in the movement, and there was just no, you bet, and
mm-hmm.
so we didn't, there was no way that anybody
mm-hmm.
could subvert us, because in the first
mm-hmm.
place, they wouldn't even think about it, they didn't think
mm-hmm.
we were that important, and
mm-hmm.
in the second place, they wouldn't have a prayer,
mm-hmm.
because we were very much a group, you know, a cell of
mm-hmm.
like-minded people, and so I think, and then, of course, that was, once I resigned from the society, that was when Tina Stoneroff took over and
mm-hmm.
became the executive secretary. And then, so I was kind of batting around, not quite knowing what to do, and the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission was formed,
mm-hmm.
and I was offered a post as commissioner, and so that took up the next 7 years, from 72 to 79, I was on that, in addition to being very active in the Wilderness Society nationally.
Mm-hmm.
I was the 70s were when I was really in, you know, involved in traveling constantly and
being involved in a lot of different sorts of things.
On the conservation issue and land use.
Yeah, pretty much, because even on the Land Use Planning Commission, Dick Cooley and I were the ones who sort of upheld the conservationist banner. And I think that also illustrates the other thing that I think has been very true in my life, and I've told you this before, and that is that when the time has come to make a change, the opportunity opens. And it's just happened to me, and it's happened so often that I just sort of believe in it now.
Mm-hmm.
I have the very real great faith that when I am about to, when I get to the end of something, something else opens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I can sense that point by the fact that I get restless and I'm
mm-hmm.
not really satisfied with what I'm doing, and there are
mm-hmm.
other things that I, you know, I'm, it's very, very amorphous and very vague, but
mm-hmm.
I know that a change is imminent and
mm-hmm.
it'll have to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's primarily one of the major things. I've never really set out to be anything or to do anything specific in my life, except on the, you know, in the short term as part of my
mm-hmm.
my
mm-hmm.
whatever I'm into. But in terms of planning a life, it just happens. You know, and
life is really that way. No matter what you try to do, it sort of has its own way of working out.
I'm pretty sure that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Jenny had she just wrote a piece for the from the woodpile for the Northern Line, which is the Northern Alaska Environmental Center
mm-hmm.
newsletter,
mm-hmm.
and she was looking at the elections, you know, and
mm-hmm.
commenting on the feeling, you know, that we're pretty helpless in the face of all these circumstances that have occurred. And then she winds up saying, well, probably the cosmic forces are working things out in their own way, and we'll, you know, whatever's going to be, will be. we're going to worry about it, and we're going to, you know, there's just no way that you can, can really change things by thinking about them. It's going to, we are very much a creature of synchronicity, and I think the older you get, the more you become aware that there has to be a meaning in a lot of these things. I was just reading my Utney Reader, which is a sort of Reader's Digest of offbeat newspaper, old different periodicals. Anyway, they have an interview with Shirley MacLaine,
mm-hmm.
and very much in the mood of her
mm-hmm.
out on a limb. And she was talking about the fact that things don't just happen.
Mm-hmm.
For no reason, that there is a reason, whether you can understand it or not,
right.
whether you see it
mm-hmm.
in your right. own, you know, to you it seems very, very happenstance.
Uh-huh.
But you have to, if you look back on it from the future, you look back and see, and you'll see that it sort of marched along.
And even so, you have done what you felt you had to do at any given time to move things along or to have something happen.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you're certainly not saying that you sat back.
Oh, you're not being passive. No.
No, it's not a passive thing, and that's
mm-hmm.
what I wanted to make clear. I mean,
no.
Yeah,
it isn't passivity. It isn't just having things
mm-hmm.
done to you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a matter of in the overall direction, having a faith that it is going to be open to you, that
mm-hmm.
you don't have to,
mm-hmm.
that you don't have to decide, well, I'm going to do this and this and this and this, and that's going to get you where you want to be, because
mm-hmm.
it very often doesn't. And you get there by going backwards.
So often you get there by going backwards.
Well, that's true.
But.
And I think sometimes you almost have to turn your back on where you think you want to be or what you want to do in order to approach it from the right angle, so that if you pull your way ahead, and I often think of it in relation to my learning to ski, that I would have been far better off had I not just sort of hung in there with Jenny and all these people that ski better than I did. If I had just calmly said, okay, you guys, you go play for a while, and I'm going to learn to ski, and gone
mm-hmm.
off and learned to ski well, and then come back and join them, because it would have been
mm-hmm.
a much better, a much more advanced skill, and I'd be a much better downhill skier today. But
You see, you keep thinking, well, I don't want to let go of this because if I do, I'm going to lose out. And very often, by letting go of whatever it is that you think is so important to you, you get it more firmly later. You just have to realize that that's going to happen to you. And that's a leap of faith many times.
Mm-hmm.
Because you may be parting company with somebody you really like and you really feel deeply about, but maybe you have to go do something else in order to really make that work,
mm-hmm.
that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I've thought about that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know. I was going to say it's too bad we can't have some of these insights a lot earlier. But maybe that's part of the whole thing, too.
I don't know.
I'm sure that what happens in actual fact is you do have these so-called insights, but you don't pay any attention to them. I should just say that again. I think we've got enough time to just say that.
Well, I think that instead of saying you don't see the patterns when you're young, I think you have to almost live through things and then look back
to see,
and then the patterns
emerge
and emerge.
Emerge, yeah.